paraphernalia. I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Ashley reports on climate activists who are targeting famous artworks in protest. The activists say they are trying to bring attention to the climate crisis worldwide. But some say their actions hurt the activists' cause. Later, Faith Perlow answers a question from a listener about the difference between the words still and yet. We finish with a story by O. Henry called A Retrieved Reformation. But first,
in recent weeks, climate activists have thrown tomato soup, spread potatoes, and even attached themselves to famous paintings. The activists have said their actions were meant to call attention to the burning of fossil fuels and the environmental crisis worldwide. Last month, two activists dumped tomato soup over Vincent van Gogh's Sunflowers at London's National Gallery. What is worth more, art or life? The two activists asked people in the gallery. Is it worth more than food? More than justice? Are you more concerned about the protection of a painting or the protection of our planet and people? Weeks later, two other climate activists spread potatoes on a glass-covered painting by French painter Claude Monet inside a German museum. Another activist attached his head to the glass covering of a famous Johannes Vermeer painting, Girl with a Pearl Earring, at The Hague in Amsterdam. In a video widely seen online, the man who glued his head to Vermeer's painting asked, "How do you feel when you see something beautiful and priceless, apparently, being destroyed before your eyes?" He added, "Where is that feeling when you see the planet being destroyed?" The actions followed a recent incident in which activists threw cake at the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. Activists also glued themselves to a copy of Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper at London's Royal Academy of Arts, Sandro Botticelli's Primavera at the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, Italy, and a sculpture at the Vatican. Alex de Koning is a spokesman for Just Stop Oil, the group responsible for throwing cans of soup at Van Gogh's painting. He said the group will attack paintings and art until the government makes a meaningful statement about ending new fossil fuel assets in the UK. He told Euronews, "There are still people who are way more outraged about that action than the 33 million people in Pakistan being displaced by floods." But University of Pennsylvania climate scientist Michael Mann said he worries that the actions will hurt the activists' cause. He told the Associated Press that such actions will alienate people who are natural allies in the climate battle. Some of those people, Mann said, will draw negative associations with climate advocacy and activism from such acts. Dana Fisher is a social scientist at the University of Maryland. She said the activists seemed to have targeted paintings that have a glass cover to cause less damage. She told the AP, "These tactics are specifically geared toward getting media attention." Attacks on artwork have long gotten people's attention. In 1914, a supporter of women's voting rights cut The Toilet of Venus, a famous painting by Spanish artist Diego Velázquez, in London's National Gallery. During the Vietnam War, an Iranian artist sprayed the words "Kill Lies All" on Pablo Picasso's anti-war painting, Guernica, at New York's Museum of Modern Art. The most famous painting of all, Mona Lisa, has been attacked more than any other work of art. People have thrown rocks, chemicals, paint, and even a teacup at Da Vinci's painting over the years. The Louvre has since put Mona Lisa behind bulletproof glass and kept visitors some distance away. Following the attack on Girl with a Pearl Earring, a Dutch cultural official said, "Everyone has the right to make a point, but please leave our shared heritage alone. Attacking defenseless works of art is not the right way."
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question about the difference between still and yet. Dear teacher, I am delighted to write you this email. I am hoping that I will get some good explanations about using similar words, such as still and yet. Looking forward to reading the answer. Thank you. Arios from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dear Arios, thank you for writing to us. We still have not covered this subject. Still and yet have very different meanings and uses. Yet, in some situations, they can be used in the same way. Let us begin by looking at still. Although still can be an adjective, noun, or verb, we often use it as an adverb. As an adverb, still describes an action that began in the past and continues into the present. We often use it before the base verb. For example, she still talks with her college friends years later. I have been eating all day, but I'm still hungry. Using still in negative statements means that the action should change, but it has not. I still haven't finished cleaning. There's just too much to do. Let's move on to yet. Yet can be either an adverb or a conjunction, which links two clauses together. As an adverb, yet refers to an action that has not happened, but is expected. Someone might be waiting for it to happen. We often use it with negative statements. As a conjunction, yet means but at the same time. Let us look at a few examples. You want to get the project done, yet you also want to be fair with everyone involved. They aimed to honor the establishment of the policy, yet it had many shortcomings that left members unsure. Both of these sentences contain two clauses involving action that is taking place at the same time. Other uses as a conjunction can show difference. The sun is out, yet it is very cold. Yet is used to create a contrast and combine the clauses into one sentence. Yet can also be used as an adverb. I have yet to receive my package. In this case, the person is waiting for their package to arrive.
Have you made dinner yet, Faith?
No, I haven't. I've been too busy working. Yet is often used at the end of the statement or question. Both yet and still can be used in the same way when talking about situations in the past, using negative statements that continue into the present. He still has not returned my phone call. He has not returned my phone call yet. Note that still goes before the verb, and yet is at the end of the sentence. Some native speakers notice a slightly different tone when saying these words aloud. If still is used, this could be a sign of being upset or impatient with the situation, especially if still is emphasized while speaking. As in, he still has not returned my phone call. Please let us know if these explanations have helped you, Arios. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
A retrieved reformation. In a prison shoe shop, Jimmy Valentine was busily at work making shoes. A prison officer came into the shop and led Jimmy to the prison office. There, Jimmy was given an important paper. It said that he was free. Jimmy took the paper without showing much pleasure or interest. He had been sent to prison to stay for 4 years. He had been there for 10 months. But he had expected to stay only 3 months. Jimmy Valentine had many friends outside the prison. A man with so many friends does not expect to stay in prison long.
"Valentine," said the chief prison officer, "you'll go out tomorrow morning. This is your chance. Make a man of yourself. You're not a bad fellow at heart. Stop breaking safes open and live a better life. Me? Said Jimmy in surprise. I never broke into a safe in my life. Oh, no, the chief prison officer laughed. Never. Let's see. How did you happen to get sent to prison for opening that safe in Springfield? Was it because you didn't want to tell where you really were? Perhaps you were with some lady and you didn't want to tell her name. Or was it because the judge didn't like you? You men always have a reason like that. You never go to prison because you broke open a safe. Me? Jimmy said. His face still showed surprise. I was never in Springfield in my life. Take him away, said the chief prison officer. Get him the clothes he needs for going outside. Bring him here again at 7 in the morning. And think about what I said, Valentine. At 7:15 on the next morning, Jimmy stood again in the office. He had on some new clothes that did not fit him and a pair of new shoes that hurt his feet. These are the usual clothes given to a prisoner when he leaves the prison. Next, they gave him money to pay for his trip on a train to the city near the prison. They gave him $5 more. The $5 was supposed to help him become a better man. Then the chief prison officer put out his hand for a handshake. That was the end of Valentine, prisoner 9762. Mr. James Valentine walked out into the sunshine. He did not listen to the song of the birds or look at the green trees or smell the flowers. He went straight to a restaurant. There he tasted the first sweet joys of being free. He had a good dinner. After that, he went to the train station. He gave some money to a blind man who sat there asking for money, and then he got on the train. 3 hours later, he got off the train in a small town. Here, he went to the restaurant of Mike Dolan. Mike Dolan was alone there. After shaking hands, he said, I'm sorry we couldn't do it sooner, Jimmy, my boy. But there was that safe in Springfield, too. It wasn't easy. Feeling all right? Fine, said Jimmy. Is my room waiting for me? He went up and opened the door of a room at the back of the house. Everything was as he had left it. It was here they had found Jimmy when they took him to prison. There on the floor was a small piece of cloth. It had been torn from the coat of the cop as Jimmy was fighting to escape. There was a bed against the wall. Jimmy pulled the bed toward the middle of the room. The wall behind it looked like any wall. But now Jimmy found and opened a small door in it. From this opening, he pulled out a dust-covered bag. He opened this and looked lovingly at the tools for breaking open a safe. No finer tools could be found anyplace. They were complete. Everything needed was there. They had been made of a special material in the necessary sizes and shapes. Jimmy had planned them himself, and he was very proud of them. It had cost him over $900 to have these tools made at a place where they make such things for men who work at the job of safe breaking. In half an hour, Jimmy went downstairs and through the restaurant. He was now dressed in good clothes that fitted him well. He carried his dusted and cleaned bag. "Do you have everything planned?" asked Mike Dolan. "Me?" asked Jimmy, as if surprised. "I don't understand. I work for the New York famous bread and cake makers company. I sell the best bread and cake in the country." Mike enjoyed these words so much that Jimmy had to take a drink with him. Jimmy had some milk. He never drank anything stronger. A week after Valentine 9762 left the prison, a safe was broken open in Richmond, Indiana. No one knew who did it. $800 were taken. 2 weeks after that, a safe in Logansport was opened. It was a new kind of safe. It had been made, they said, so strong that no one could break it open. But someone did and took $1,500. Then a safe in Jefferson City was opened. $5,000 were taken. This loss was a big one. Ben Price was a cop who worked on such important matters, and now he began to work on this. He went to Richmond, Indiana, and to Logansport to see how the safe breaking had been done in those places. He was heard to say, "I can see that Jim Valentine has been here. He's in business again. Look at the way he opened this one. Everything easy, everything clean. He's the only man who has the tools to do it. And He's the only man who knows how to use tools like this. Yes, I want Mr. Valentine. Next time he goes to prison, he's going to stay there until his time is finished. Ben Price knew how Jimmy worked. Jimmy would go from one city to another, far away. He always worked alone. He always left quickly when he was finished. He enjoyed being with nice people. For all these reasons, it was not easy to catch Mr. Valentine. People with safes full of money were glad to hear that Ben Price was at work trying to catch Mr. Valentine. One afternoon, Jimmy Valentine and his bag arrived in a small town named Elmore. Jimmy, looking as young as a college boy, walked down the street towards a hotel. A young lady walked across the street, passing him at the corner, and entered a door. Over the door was the sign, "The Elmore Bank." Jimmy Valentine looked into her eyes, forgetting at once what he was. He became another man. She looked away, and brighter color came into her face. Young men like Jimmy did not appear often in Elmore. Jimmy saw a boy near the bank door and began to ask questions about the town. After a time, the young lady came out and went on her way. She seemed not to see Jimmy as she passed him. "Isn't that young lady Polly Simpson?" asked Jimmy.
"No," said the boy. "She's Annabel Adams. Her father owns this bank."
Jimmy went to the hotel, where he said his name was Ralph D. Spencer. He got a room there. He told the hotel man that he had come to Elmore to go into business. How was the shoe business? Was there already a good shoe shop? The man thought that Jimmy's clothes and manners were fine. He was happy to talk to him. Yes, Elmore needed a good shoe shop. There was no shop that sold just shoes. Shoes were sold in the big shops that sold everything. All business in Elmore was good. He hoped Mr. Spencer would decide to stay in Elmore. It was a pleasant town to live in, and the people were friendly. Mr. Spencer said that he would stay in town a few days and learn something about it. No, he said he himself would carry his bag up to the room. He didn't want a boy to take it. It was very heavy. Mr. Ralph Spencer remained in Elmore. He started a shoe shop. Business was good. Also, he made many friends, and he was successful with the wish of his heart. He met Annabel Adams. He liked her better every day. At the end of a year, everyone in Elmore liked Mr. Ralph Spencer. His shoe shop was doing very good business, and he and Annabel were going to be married in 2 weeks. Mr. Adams, the small-town banker, liked Spencer. Annabel was very proud of him. He seemed already to belong to the Adams family. One day, Jimmy sat down in his room to write this letter, which he sent to one of his old friends. "Dear old friend, I want you to meet me at Sullivan's place next week on the evening of the 10th. I want to give you my tools. I know you'll be glad to have them. You couldn't buy them for $1,000. I finished with the old business a year ago. I have a nice shop, I'm living a better life, and I'm going to marry the best girl on earth 2 weeks from now. It's the only life. I would never again touch another man's money. After I marry, I'm going to go further west, where I'll never see anyone who knew me in my old life. I tell you, she's a wonderful girl. She trusts me. Your old friend, Jimmy." On the Monday night after Jimmy sent this letter, Ben Price arrived quietly in Elmore. He moved slowly about the town in his quiet way. He learned all that he wanted to know. Standing inside a shop, he watched Ralph D. Spencer walk by.
"You're going to marry the banker's daughter, are you, Jimmy?" said Ben to himself. "I don't feel sure about that."
The next morning, Jimmy was at the Adams home. He was going to a nearby city that day to buy new clothes for the wedding. He was also going to buy a gift for Annabel. It would be his first trip out of Elmore. It was more than a year now since he had done any safe-breaking. Most of the Adams family went to the bank together that morning. There were Mr. Adams, Annabel, Jimmy and Annabel's married sister with their two little girls aged 5 and 9. They passed Jimmy's hotel, and Jimmy ran up to his room and brought along his bag. Then they went to the bank. All went inside, Jimmy too, for he was one of the family. Everyone in the bank was glad to see the good-looking, nice young man who was going to marry Annabel.
Jimmy put down his bag. Annabelle, laughing, put Jimmy's hat on her head and picked up the bag.
"How do I look?"
she asked.
"Ralph, how heavy this bag is. It feels full of gold."
"It's full of some things I don't need in my shop," Jimmy said. "I'm taking them to the city, to the place where they came from. That saves me the cost of sending them. I'm going to be a married man. I must learn to save money." The Elmore Bank had a new safe. Mr. Adams was very proud of it, and he wanted everyone to see it. It was as large as a small room, and it had a very special door. The door was controlled by a clock. Using the clock, the banker planned the time when the door would open. At other times, no one, not even the banker himself, could open it. He explained about it to Mr. Spencer. Mr. Spencer seemed interested, but he did not seem to understand very easily. The two children, May and Agatha, enjoyed seeing the shining heavy door with all its special parts. While they were busy like this, Ben Price entered the bank and looked around. He told a young man who worked there that he had not come on business. He was waiting for a man. Suddenly there was a cry from the women. They had not been watching the children. May, the 9-year-old, had playfully but firmly closed the door of the safe, and Agatha was inside. The old banker tried to open the door. He pulled at it for a moment. "The door can't be opened," he cried. "And the clock! I hadn't started it yet." Agatha's mother cried out again. "Quiet," said Mr. Adams, raising a shaking hand. "All be quiet for a moment. Agatha," he called as loudly as he could, "listen to me." They could hear, but not clearly, the sound of the child's voice. In the darkness inside the safe, she was wild with fear.
"My baby," her mother cried. "She will die of fear. Open the door. Break it open. Can't you men do something?"
"There isn't a man nearer than the city who could open that door," said Mr. Adams in a shaking voice. "My God, Spencer, what shall we do? That child, she can't live long in there. There isn't enough air, and the fear will kill her." Agatha's mother, wild too now, beat on the door with her hands. Annabelle turned to Jimmy, her large eyes full of pain, but with some hope, too. A woman thinks that the man she loves can somehow do anything.
"Can't you do something, Ralph? Try, won't you?"
He looked at her with a strange, soft smile on his lips and in his eyes. "Annabelle," he said, "give me that flower you're wearing, will you?" She could not believe that she had really heard him, but she put the flower in his hand. Jimmy took it and put it where he could not lose it. Then he pulled off his coat. With that act, Ralph D. Spencer passed away, and Jimmy Valentine took his place. "Stand away from the door, all of you," he commanded. He put his bag on the table and opened it flat. From that time on, he seemed not to know that anyone else was near. Quickly, he laid the shining, strange tools on the table. The others watched as if they had lost the power to move. In a minute, Jimmy was at work on the door. In 10 minutes, faster than he had ever done it before, he had the door open. Agatha was taken into her mother's arms. Jimmy Valentine put on his coat and picked up the flower and walked toward the front door. As he went, he thought he heard a voice call,
"Ralph!"
He did not stop. At the door, a big man stood in his way.
"Hello, Ben," said Jimmy, still with his strange smile. "You're here at last, are you? Let's go. I don't care now."
And then Ben Price acted rather strangely.
"I guess you were wrong about this, Mr. Spencer," he said. "I don't believe I know you, do I?"
And Ben Price turned and walked slowly down the street.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.